Welcome to Divan im Gespräch, the video podcast of Der Divan, the Arabic Cultural House here in Berlin. I'm Darius and my co-moderator today is Merit. As you may have noticed, this is our first English episode, so don't worry, we'll have, as always, German and Arabic subtitles, so you will be able to follow the discussion. You just need to turn on the subtitles in the YouTube settings. So today I'm happy to welcome Professor Iyad Rahwan to the podcast. Professor Rahwan is director of the Max Planck Institute for Human Development in Berlin, where he founded and directs the Center for Humans and Machines. He is also an honorary professor of electrical engineering and computer science at the Technical University of Berlin. Prior to moving to Berlin, he was an associate professor of media arts and sciences at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT. Born in Aleppo, Syria, Rahwan holds a PhD from the University of Melbourne and is also an interdisciplinary artist who uses AI as part of his artistic work. In that regard, he hosted his three-month exhibition Portraits of the Artificial here at the Divan last year, together with the curator Nadim Saman. Iyad, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Maybe could you briefly share a few words about you and your personal background, especially like being born in Aleppo and then moving to Australia, the US, and then to Germany?
Sure, yeah. So I was born in Aleppo in a very turbulent time. This was 1978. Which was, yeah, quite a difficult time in Syria. When I was four, my parents are civil engineers, both of them, and my dad got a job in Abu Dhabi. Mm-hmm. And basically the family moved with him, myself and mom and two smaller brothers, and grew up mostly in Abu Dhabi. So I went to, you know, schools there, and with the exception of 1 year in grade 10, where I spent it in Aleppo as well. And it gave me a very good perspective about life there. Subsequently, my family went back to Syria. I studied my computer science degree at UAE University. Mm-hmm. in Al Ain, and then went, moved to Australia to immigrate as well as to complete my PhD in Melbourne. So I picked up a degree and a wife, and then went to back to the Middle East. So there, this was around 2004, where basically the Gulf states were beginning this new, how should I call it, kind of renaissance or kind of renewal of interest in science and academia, and they were starting lots of different universities. So I joined one of those universities in Dubai, called the British University in Dubai, and I worked there for 5 years. And most of these universities, or a lot of them, had connections with Western institutions. So in this case, it had a connection with the University of Edinburgh, which was always like a way to ensure quality, but also gives kind of assurances, especially to people like me, that this institution has like good backing and it has good ambitions. Subsequently, I moved to another institution called Masdar Institute, which is located in Abu Dhabi in this zero carbon city, in which you cannot drive. Mm-hmm. So you had to you drive outside, you park your car outside, and then you drive, or you go to the office using these self-driving pods, kind of primitive mm-hmm. self-driving cars. This was around 2010. This institute had a connection with the MIT, with the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, as well. 5 years later, I got a position at MIT. So I moved to start my own lab and be on the faculty at the Media Lab at MIT, and was there for a few years, 4 years, and then I got this offer to join the Max Planck Society, which I think is a very special place. Mm-hmm. And that's how I moved to Berlin in 2019. So my journey, you know, I've lived in many continents, many countries. It's always been moving between disciplines as well, and I can talk a little bit more about that later.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and how would you describe all those coming from so many different cultural contexts? How did this shape your like academic way of finding research subjects?
I guess it, you know, these things, the experiences shape us as human beings, and then scientists are ultimately human beings as well. So it shapes the way you approach science, perhaps. So I guess in one sense, I was always a little bit of an outsider. So moving from the UA from Syria to the UAE, you know, you're a guest. You have great opportunities, but you're still a guest. You know, and then going to Australia, even becoming a citizen there, is still kind of culturally different in some senses. So I think this gives a person an opportunity to observe things from a different perspective. You know, you observe them from the outside. And then even going back to the Middle East, I was able to look at my own culture, my own kind of part of the world, also with a different eye. So this idea or this imperative to be able to always reflect on the new, but also to re-reflect on the old and on the familiar, I think was always kind of shaped me and the way I look at the world. But also as a scientist, it also shaped the way I approach science. So I don't see myself as belonging to one discipline. So I was trained in computer science, but I also had interests in other areas, for example, in psychology, in economics and sociology and other related fields. So I was always able to say, not define myself only as a single computer scientist. My identity was scientific identity was a bit more distributed. And that meant also that I don't have any issues working with people, collaborating across disciplines, even though it was a little bit risky. So I think that shaped me in this way. And also experiences, you know, you meet people and these people shape you also in some way. So for example, one of my closest friends was studying at the UAE University and we were roommates and he was studying psychology and I was studying computer science and I always found his courses really fascinating. And would pick up the books and would attend the lectures and I took some courses in psychology as well as part of my studies. This all kind of opened my mind, I think, a bit to other disciplines. So at the moment, I'm kind of, as a result, you know, like fast forward, now 20 years after my PhD, I've been described as a computer scientist, an ethicist, an anthropologist, a psychologist, and a few others. So in some ways, this I think I consider a success because it means that I'm really kind of like, you don't have to have labels and you don't have to have definitions. You know, I'm interested in the phenomenon, I'm interested in the questions, and that's what matters. And I'm happy to work with people from all of these disciplines to answer those questions and to achieve the scientific objective.
Thank you so much. I guess we would love to come back to the cultural differences and aspects later on. You just, very nicely said that scientists are human beings as well. Scientists are not necessarily artists. But this is something that holds true for you. So could you maybe, just for the beginning now, also tell us a bit more about your artistic work and what inspires your science or like how your science inspires your artist work?
Yeah, I guess the whole thing started very early. So as a child, growing up in Abu Dhabi, son of two engineers, my mother was very encouraging of my scientific kind of interests, and she was the one always helping me with mathematics and kind of supporting my technical interests. My dad also gave this kind of an example of a person who can combine interests. So he was a civil engineer, but I really think he just wanted to be an artist or a designer. So he had he was a painter as well on the side. He had a few exhibitions in Abu Dhabi. So I grew up seeing that, look, it's possible to do both, you know, even in a kind of a, you know, this is 1980s Abu Dhabi, right? Like this is very different from what was happening now. And all of this, I think, opens possibilities, you know, so you don't see things as, you know, single track. So this is kind of maybe the roots of my interest. So I always was interested in art, but I never got any kind of formal training in art. But I was always like also like a frustrated kind of artist in some sense. And then during the pandemic, you know, lockdown, we had two small children during this time, and you go mad, you know, like I'm starting a new lab. You know, we moved here to Berlin in 2020, the pandemic starts, and our second daughter is born. So now we have, you know, and we're in the house, right? And I have to start a new lab. I have to hire scientists. You know, this is all beginning to build a whole research center from scratch under these conditions. So it was quite a tough situation. So I needed some kind of something to do, right? That is easy, that you can kind of stop, you know, a hobby that you can do indoors safely, and that you can drop and go, you know, maybe change some diapers and come back, right? And this is where I decided to take up my artistic interests a bit more, and I kind of taught myself oil painting. And, you know, initially started painting the family and landscapes and things like this, things that interested me, scenes from Aleppo and so on. And then I started just have this urge to put like a kind of a giant robot in the landscape, you know, in the distance. And I think it was at the time where I felt like AI, it was kind of an emotional expression of this force that was coming. In the distance, you know, we have an idyllic landscape, and then you have this life as usual. Mm-hmm. And in the distance, this tsunami is coming, you know, this massive technological force is arriving. And, you know, I wanted to kind of depict that, you know, as an expression or a way of kind of dealing with it. So, and this slowly grew into, you know, kind of more and more paintings. And then a good friend of mine, Sultan Al-Khasimi, was visiting the city, Berlin, and he saw them and he encouraged me. He said, you know, you should do more of this. You know, this is really good. You should just make them bigger and so on. So he gave me a few tips and kind of the permission, let's say, to actually do an exhibition. Mm-hmm. So I really went for it. And I created a body of work. And during this time, ChatGPT came out, and I was able to actually start painting the machine based on what it wants to look like, right? Or how it sees itself and how it sees its relationship to people. So, and that grew into this exhibition. So to kind of comment on the relationship between science and art, I feel like as a scientist, you have to be really careful. You have to back everything with evidence. So you're not supposed to speculate too much, you know, because you have the data and you have to stay within what the data tells you. So I think art gives me this channel or opportunity or permission to speculate, to be vague, to be kind of, you know, subjective rather than objective. And I feel it felt like a really nice complement to the science, because you know, as a scientist, we're doing experiments, but I have kind of have emotional maybe reactions to those experiments. You find interesting things, but these emotions can't make it to the scientific article, right? They should be they should have a different place. So, and I think that's where art kind of for me is a channel for expressing those feelings and those thoughts and those ideas, and at some point they start kind of becoming symbiotic with each other, the scientific side and the artistic side.
Well, what I find so interesting about your artistic side is that it also has this kind of a research question, like a scientist would work. So maybe other artists have this as well, but in your, especially this project's portraits of the artificial, maybe you can explain a little bit how you approached this whole project, which questions you were asking yourself and the machine, yep, and what the results were.
Yeah, I think it's a good way of putting it, that the art is also driven by a kind of question, right? So there was a bit of an evolution to this. So initially, the question was, how do I feel about artificial intelligence as a technological force that will shape our society, maybe completely alter it. And I have, you know, I feel a bit of maybe anxiety. I feel excitement also. I want to be part of this. I want to see see it materialize in the world. I have curiosity. I want to see what it looks like. Maybe I have a kind of a sense of, you know, that this thing is a bit of a, something like a child, you know, that it needs us to thrive and not to go down the wrong path. So it needs to be aligned. It's called the alignment problem in computer science. So all of these feelings were about my reaction, right? And so the initial paintings were always trying to give a face to the algorithms that will capture this feeling that I have about it. Mm. So, you know, maybe it sometimes comes across as intimidating, you know, maybe it's judging. You know, we are judged by algorithms every day. You know? Like you post something on social media and whether it gets promoted or not is decided by a machine. And people even say, you know, today I was blessed by the algorithm, like on, when an artist's post goes viral on Instagram.
Mm. Almost religious terms.
Exactly. They're even using these kind of religious terms because they're using them a little bit kind of, let's say, like spirits, you know, like it's something that's out there that, that maybe acts in the world, but like we don't really fully understand it. So it's kind of ethereal, you know. And so these are all feelings that people have, right? So I thought that maybe other people will also relate to these feelings, you know, that sometimes the portrait, you know, obviously you have to personify these things, and I chose to personify them as kind of anthropomorphic robots. Mm. Sometimes they look, you know, curious, sometimes they look intimidating, sometimes they look friendly and kind of seductive in some way. And this was the first series. But then when ChatGPT came out, you know, now I can have a conversation. You know, you can have a really sophisticated conversation with these machines now. And it's really mind-blowing, I think, if especially as a computer scientist, knowing how difficult this was, how many people, how many tens of thousands of scientists, hundreds of thousands of scientists were working on every small aspect of this problem. Mm. You know, can it understand grammar? Can it construct sentences? Can it translate correctly? Can it express kind of sentiment or understand sentiment? All of these were like, you know, entire conferences would be dedicated to each one of those things. Yeah. And now it's all solved, like just like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not all solved, but like a big chunk of it is solved. And now you can speak to it.
And it is accessible.
Exactly. And so for me, it's like, I mean, for everybody else, it's like magic. But even for me as a computer scientist, it's magic. And even the people who developed it did not see it coming. You know, the people who developed the architecture that produced this large language models, you know, like ChatGPT and Gemini and so on, did not see it coming a few years ago. So everybody's shocked and we're all in awe. So now I can talk to it and I can involve it in the artistic process. And this was kind of like a new affordance, right? Mm. If, you know, you can think of it as a tool. It's like a new kind of brush, right? but you can also think of it as a new subject, you know, that if I'm painting it, it's also talking to me and it's mm-hmm. explaining to me how it wants to be perceived. And this led to like a kind of what I find more interesting series of paintings where these AIs are involved in the construction of their own image. Mm. Now, you know, you could say it's just a machine. Nevertheless, this is why art is nice, because even if it's just a machine, the concept, the idea that a machine could construct its own image, could have preferences, you know, could tell me, I prefer to be depicted this way and not this way, and could even tell me, I don't want to show you some aspects of my psyche. Like this is what, you know, what the machine was saying. So I think this was, for me, really fascinating on an artistic level. I hope to also study it scientifically, but I think it's, you know, characterizing the psychology of these AIs is still kind of a hot topic of scientific research. So now I started thinking that the conversation itself is part of the artwork. Mm-hmm. Because I think it's maybe the more interesting aspect. Because in the end, I mean, I do, you know, use my brush to paint the portrait in the end on canvas. But I think the most interesting part is the conversation that I, as a scientist and artist, am having with this inanimate, mm-hmm. well, animated machine that's exhibiting signs of intelligence.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we talked a lot now already about the interactions of humans and machines and the personification of machines, as you were describing it, that you use like in or implement in your artistic work. We've heard already in the very beginning that you founded and are directing the Center for Humans and Machines. And it is one of the crucial aspects of your research. Now, I'm curious, like what reveals or what the name of the center reveals about this interaction. So will machines take over within the next decade and then rename the center with the name Center for Machines and Humans?
That's an interesting proposition. Yeah, now I think I will always want to put humans first. At least this is the hope for now. Unless, you know, in 10 years, the director of the center becomes a machine and then the director can decide to change the name, presumably, which by which time I will have lost my job and have bigger problems than that, than the title. But yeah, the name is really... What I wanted to convey with this name is that we don't live in a human world anymore. We live in a world in which there are humans and there are intelligent machines, and they're advancing rapidly, and they're shaping everything, including the human condition. You know, and this is why I think this is why I wanted the name to capture this, the fact that we are intertwined. So our fate and the fate of the machine are intertwined from now on. We live in a world where machines plan our movements. They recommend our consumption, media consumption. They determine, you know, they diagnose us. They give us a health diagnosis and suggest, you know, treatments and so on. So they really kind of impact every aspect of our lives. And now they're getting into other areas, like we are able to delegate more and more tasks to them. We are able to have relationships with them. You know, people are having AI friends, sometimes even romantic partners that they fall in love with. Machines are exerting power, you know, and influence on us. They're fighting wars and killing people. You know, like this is not a benign kind of phenomenon, right? So, with all of this, what does it mean? You know, how is this relationship going to be shaped? This is a question way beyond, you know, my research center. But I think I would like to, I hope that we play a small role, a constructive role in understanding this phenomenon. And to do this, I think you need people who understand human behavior, human psychology, social behavior, social dynamics, economic dynamics, but also people who have computer science skills and who understand the technology. So my team is split 50-50. Between computer scientists and behavioral scientists, and together we explore these questions in novel ways.
Yeah, I think later on we should definitely discuss this question of who is able to define where it's going with AI, where the regulations are, limitations, like who decides the direction of this development. I think that's a really important question, but to stay here with the question of what does AI or ChatGPT and large language models, what can they do with us humans? Like in terms of, can they inspire us? Can they kill us? So there are so many different ways in which directions it goes or it can go. Can you maybe bring a few examples? Like I had in mind this example of the computer AlphaGo, who won against the human player in the sport game Go, which was kind of a revolutionary thing because nobody imagined it would even be possible. But the most interesting thing was for me to learn that the Go players really learned from that loss. They got better and got inspired until this day to play even more creative. So that I think that's a great example to see things happening which we didn't imagine before. What's your take on this? Is AI like going this way, or is it the darker sides are going to be more prominent?
Absolutely. So When I say AI is really altering the human condition in a way, I'm not exaggerating. I think it's really altering how we conduct everything. Now, you could say, well, it's only accelerating things or it's only making things more efficient. But I think it's more than that. It's qualitatively changing some things. But I think it's, you know, we still don't understand exactly how that happens. But I think, as you mentioned, the game of Go was, I think, a monumental event. Computers have defeated world champions in board games for a long time. You know, since Deep Blue defeated Kasparov in chess. There have been lots of other similar victories, like the game of checkers, the game, you know, different variants of poker. And also, you know, computers were able to play games like World of Warcraft and things like that. So, you know, we've seen all of this before. What's special about the game of Go and that particular example is that the machine was able to discover not just better strategies that follow the same kind of human intuition, but completely alien strategies. So strategies that humans were unable to discover because they were exploring in a different part of the strategy space, right? So they were, so in a way, and the machine did this because it did not learn from humans. It learned by playing with copies of itself. So it was able to essentially discover something that looked kind of stupid, a stupid move. I think it's called move 37 in the game. Human players were just unable to understand why would it do such a move. And then later on, it turned out to be decisive for the victory. And then later, machines started studying these moves, especially when there were more open source models for playing this game, and they learned the strategy. And I think this is monumental because this is every tool we built in the past gave us, it changed how we do things, but it was still subject to our own will, right? Like we manipulated the world with this tool. And it didn't change the way we solve problems. You know, I mean, it gave us new affordances, it opened up possibilities. But it did not in itself discover a new way of thinking, let's say. Mm-hmm. And I think this is what's happened in the case of Go. And and I think this will happen more. In some cases, it doesn't really happen, or the machine discovers something, but is unable to explain it to us. Mm-hmm. So, for example, also from DeepMind, AlphaFold is an algorithm that is beats the benchmark in predicting protein folding, which is a very important problem in biochemistry that I know nothing about, by the way. In this case, the machine is able to make really good predictions that will guide the scientists in which actual experiments to run, to actually see if the proteins fold in this particular way or not. But the machine has some kind of theory, understanding of this process, but it's unable to articulate it to us. So we don't learn any new theory from it. Like there's no new theoretical insight from AlphaFold. So in some sense, in this case, unlike the case of AlphaGo, we have a superhuman thinking machine that cannot explain to us its own thinking. So we cannot learn anything from it directly, like about how to think, right? We can only get the answers and then go test them. So it's more like an oracle. And I think those are going to be the two main things, you know, like is the machine going to become more of like an oracle or is it going to teach us something? And maybe it'll happen, you know, we'll have a bit of both.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. You were also like earlier describing your own ambiguity between like anxiety and excitement and curiosity when it comes to all of that. And I think this is also something where maybe like cultural differences or different cultures play a role. And I found that very interesting article that you published last year, which is called Fears About Artificial Intelligence Across 20 Countries and 6 Domains of Application. And I would be very interested to hear a bit more about your findings in this regard.
Sure, yeah. So I was, again, maybe because I lived in different cultures and I was able to see that what's obvious and kind of self-evident in one culture is not in another culture. So I was always interested in understanding the cultural differences in how people perceive in AI and how people what people expect from AI. So for example, in this study, we were interested in perception. Mm-hmm. So we were interested in whether people would be okay or would accept an AI in sensitive occupations. So for example, can an AI be a judge or a doctor or a care worker, you know, caring after children or the elderly, or can be a religious worker, you know, giving religious advice or even leading prayer, things like that. And I felt like, well, there must be cultural differences, you know, because I imagine in some cultures there would be more sensitivities, for example, about religion, for instance. We know anecdotally that people in Japan are more open to robots caring for people, for example, right? But this is kind of anecdotal. So we did this cross-cultural comparisons with 20 countries and a bunch of occupations. And we found that, yeah, there's a general kind of difference in people's willingness to have machines do these jobs. But there's also differences that depend on the job. Mm-hmm. So for example, we found that, you know, in Japan particularly, care robots are totally acceptable or much more acceptable than they are elsewhere. But also in religious service, for instance, you know, like Muslim countries, for example, are much more, you know, I don't think they would accept having a robot leading people in prayer, for instance. But we know there are churches already doing this or doing kind of a confession, you know, automate with an AI Jesus. So I think there was a group from Switzerland that did this recently. So I think, you know, it's important to understand this, these differences, because they help us design the systems better. They help us also introduce these systems into different cultures and also in a way that is sensitive to the local culture. You know, because a lot of these machines are built in one culture or very few cultures, and they're exported as kind of general purpose technologies to across the world. And in some cases, if you don't customize those AIs, they're going to clash with the local culture. They're going to make, you know, offensive comments, or they're going to, you know, not be sensitive enough, or maybe just be rejected by consumers and you know, general users.
Yeah, that would be my question regarding AI as a cultural export from the West to other cultural regions. How do you see it? Is there the danger that AI could lead to a further dominance of Western cultural hegemony?
I think there is a risk for sure. I mean, it's a technology that can speak with a billion people simultaneously, like in the movie Her, mm-hmm. you know, by Spike Jonze. The AI, Samantha, in that case, was, you know, the user is the protagonist of the movie, discovers to his shock that this robot, you know, let's say she, is speaking to like thousands of other people at the same time, right? Because machines can do that. So when a machine, an AI like ChatGPT can, you know, it garnered like 100 million users in the first few days. And now, you know, I don't know what the numbers are, but, you know, in the hundreds of millions, I imagine. So a machine that can have conversations, deep conversations, intimate conversations with people across the world, with hundreds of millions of people, has a lot of power mm-hmm. to shape narrative, to shape how we see things, to push back on some things, not push back on others, right? And I think that becomes a very powerful cultural influence tool. And I think this holds across cultures, but also within cultures. You know, you don't want like one company that has one specific kind of political orientation or political allegiance to be able to influence elections, for instance, right? By just, you know, in a small way, nudging people when they ask it for, you know, questions about like current politicians, being more critical of one politician, you know, slightly more than others, you can very easily, I think, sway elections. So I think these are all going to be big problems that we have to deal with. And what we need is tools to quantify this. So people have already been doing a little bit of this work. So there's a number of papers now, not by myself, by others, including some people from the Technical University of Munich, actually, trying to quantify the political leanings or political orientation of ChatGPT and other language models. And it's consistently shown to be left-leaning or libertarian. Mm-hmm. Very curious, or maybe not so surprising, right? Because mm-hmm. that's kind of Silicon Valley culture, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's left-leaning, libertarian. It's not conservative, it's not religious, it's not kind of centrist or whatever. It's good that we can quantify these things, because now the next step is to say, well, do we need a diversity of models? Will there be a kind of ecosystem where different companies offer different AIs that have different worldviews, different orientations, different ways of speaking about things? Will there be sovereign AI models? And I think there are a number of countries that are now working on this kind of sovereign AIs that are approved, let's say, for the country.
What does sovereign mean in that context? Do they have alignment in terms of ideological leaning? Or
I mean, I guess there's different ways of doing this. The one way is this top-down approach where you say, look, we have, every AI has to speak a certain way, right? This is one approach, and maybe some countries will do this. Mm. It should not be critical of certain, for example, sacred values or whatever, right? I can imagine another world or another country in which there are a kind of an ecosystem of models that have all kinds of, political diversity, including, bots that love conspiracy theories and bots that love to debunk conspiracy theories and so on and so forth. And people just kind of, the market selects, people select into the bots that they like and they use them and they talk to them and so on. So, which approach will dominate? I have no idea. It's really fascinating because this is now, it used to be an AI problem. Now it's a geopolitics, right? Oh, right? We're talking about geopolitics. We're talking about political dynamics within countries. Yeah. And, of course, all of the things that the political scientists know about this and have been studying will now apply to machines. So it's not, a computer scientist is not qualified really to study this question. You need a collaboration with political scientists, with people who really have been thinking about these problems for a long time, and then they need to collaborate with the computer scientists. And then I think you start to maybe understand. This is what, like, a few years ago we published a paper, conceptual paper, with a bunch of political scientists and anthropologists and economists, titled Machine Behavior. Mm. Where we're trying to invite all of these behavioral scientists from all fields to help us understand machines, and their behavior in the world. For example, the geopolitics and the social dynamics and the social influence and so on.
I would actually very much like to take some more time to talk about this. As you were saying, so the machines are very easy to shape narratives, and narratives can be very powerful, right? When it comes to the relations between countries, but also within the country itself. So let's say, as you were saying, so there's a sovereign AI, for example, for country, and it is more top-down controlled. It would give massive power to a government or a regime in place to take control about the people's thinking, if the AI is being the first tool to be asked for whatever question, for advice, for basically anything. It is very easy, or maybe the easiest it ever was, to control a whole population. I'm not entirely sure on whether we need then a global applied set of rules, or how would we actually deal with these kind of problems without interfering in other sovereign countries, right?
I mean, it's now I'm not a political scientist or a political theorist, right? I know enough to be able to say something, but I think this is far from being the last word on this. I think all of the questions that we already struggle with, questions about the limits of freedom of speech, will apply to machines. Will machines have freedom of speech? Can they say anything, or will they be banned? Will they be cancelled? Or will the companies that build them be punished in some way, fined if, you know, a machine says something racist or a machine says something blasphemous or whatever, right? I think we're going to struggle with these questions. I doubt we will reach a kind of a global consensus on this. Maybe on some things, you know, like machines should not, generate things that are harmful to children, for example, right? I think you can probably get universal consensus on this. But in terms of like political views, political opinions, religious opinions, I mean, I imagine the more likely scenario is we will live in a world with a diversity, you know, where some countries are going to be more monolithic cultures, you know, monolithic AIs that, you know, the use of any other AI will be banned. Other countries will have a, you know, more open market for these things, maybe with some rules for kind of like extreme cases or problematic cases. And, you know, the world will continue, right? As it does now already, right? Like, it's just that the machines are now talking rather than just humans. So I think this is a more likely, I don't see kind of a solution. But the question now becomes maybe if the machines have abilities to influence that are kind of too powerful. So you could say, you know, I imagine, for example, the people hold like big media corporations accountable to a greater extent than they do individuals, right? So if somebody says something in an alley that's offensive, okay, that's a problem, but like it's not the end of the world. But if the same person said this same thing on a very big media channel with, you know, 100 million followers, then people will have a bigger problem. So, you know, which rules do we apply to the machines? You know, and are they, if they're having individual conversations that are different with every person, that's fine. But if they're having the same conversation, or they're switching, or they're kind of influencing the conversation in specific ways across all conversations, right, with millions of people, then that's not so different from having broadcast, right, capabilities. Mm-hmm. And then maybe we have a problem. But then how do you even quantify this problem? How do you find out that the machine is speaking differently or is trying to achieve something, you know, like trying to get one candidate to win, for example, right? Because of the company that builds the machine likes one particular candidate. How do you even establish this? That's a scientific question, right? Yeah. I mean, we've just started, you know, now with one of my postdocs and Hiromu Yakura and others, we're starting to this is work that's currently in review, so still not published, but there's a preprint out there, and we're just trying to identify if humans are using certain words more because of ChatGPT. So, you know, and this is not controversial, so it's not political, it's not nothing like that. We're just asking, are people using the word delve more? You know, I don't know if you noticed, but I haven't used the word delve. I'm probably trying to avoid it.
Since ChatGPT.
Exactly. So ChatGPT uses this word more than average. Like it uses it much more. There are a few other words like meticulous and things like this. It's just, it's its own way of speaking. And we don't know where it came from, like whether it's from the data or, you know, from fine tuning, from the preferences that were given to it. But it just speaks in a specific way. And what we were able to find is that people are now not only using Delve in their scientific writing more, which is maybe because they copy-pasted from ChatGPT, but they're speaking this word more often, right? And we believe we found causal evidence of this, so that it really started after the introduction of ChatGPT, and you can attribute it to ChatGPT. So this is a difficult question, you know, just to even establish if a word is becoming more common, right? So, of course, this opens the door, I think, to other questions like, are we talking about specific geopolitical conflict a certain way? Are we speaking about a certain ethnic minority in a certain way because of a large language model, because of the way it speaks about them? That is a very hard question to answer. But I think it's a scientific question and may require those platforms to also be open to audit. So not just, it doesn't just need for us to develop the technology, the techniques to study these questions, but also the cooperation. And this is where you may need government intervention to say, look, you have to make your systems available, just like you have to allow your car to be subjected to CO2 emissions testing, to get certification of environmental protection. You have to also maybe certify your bot for political neutrality or something like this.
I think you once mentioned that those words like DELF and so on, they are coming from especially countries like Nigeria and Kenya, where the most of the people live who train the large language models, and they are cheap workforce, and that's one of the reasons behind it.
That could be one of the reasons. I mean, I must say that it's a hypothesis; it's not proven. Mm. I mean, it does seem that those companies like OpenAI specifically hires more people from Kenya and Nigeria to fine-tune the models, and it's also seems to be the case that they use these words more often, but. Again, we can't rule out other explanations yet. Mm-hmm. So we have to be careful. This is the scientific, careful scientist side of me. But I think it might be true. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But there are interesting alternative explanations, but this is still ongoing research.
Yeah. I mean, what I find so fascinating is when it comes to AI and machine learning, lots of scholars are always repeating, there's still so much stuff we don't know yet. And at the same time, most of those scientists say, it's really dangerous if we don't know what's actually happening. So there's those two things happening at the same time. And isn't that a very dangerous situation? Because that's what everybody is warning.
Yeah. AI risk is a really complicated topic. There are many, many people are working on this. But I would say that broadly speaking, there's like two classes of risks. Mm. One class is existential risk. So this is a risk equivalent to like the hydrogen bomb, right? Mm. Like the risk of annihilation that, all of humanity will perish. And this risk, here, those scenarios that lead to this are kind of, I think, still far off and maybe avoidable, but I don't think this is the imminent risk.
Maybe avoidable.
Maybe.
Okay.
I mean, if things continue, right? Like, things may slow down, but if things continue, we live in a very different world. But I think the more immediate risks, I mean, they are substantial, but I think they are manageable. So risk of, let's say geopolitical risks because of, influence on public opinion because of these language models or influence on the dynamics of warfare, now because you can send robots rather than humans to fight wars. You know, how does this change the calculations, of war when the price is no longer public opinion and human lives, but like just material? You know, how does this change? You know, this is people who study war, they really think about this. And so all of these things will change. It's a disruptor, it's in a similar way to any kind of technological disruptor. But I think we'll have mechanisms, we have institutional mechanisms. We're going to regulate them the way we regulate other things. We regulate toxins, we regulate nuclear energy, we regulate, for example, bioweapons, right? Like or biological kind of agents to prevent the creation of bioweapons and things like this. So we have very, very destructive technologies that we manage to control. Mm. And through all kinds of bilateral agreements, international agreements, regulatory insights and regulatory mechanisms. So I think a lot of AI is in this category. Mm-hmm. So a lot of, making sure that the doctor, AI doctor, is not going to kill you. We have ways of certifying doctors, and we have, we need to just get port and adapt some of these things to the machines. So I'm optimistic about all of this. I think it will be a bumpy ride, but I think overall, humanity will benefit. We will have better medicine, we will have better education, we'll have better mental health support, because now everybody can have access to a therapist. Mm-hmm. Like all kinds of things that will I think are very promising. Of course, there are challenges like, generation of fake deep fakes and media manipulation and warfare. And, we have to worry about those as well. But I think, again, they're not qualitatively different from like what we have been dealing with. Existential risk is another category. This is a risk that may, you know, is more a risk when machines become self-conscious, or, but we're far from this, I think, and at least we don't understand yet how it might happen. But there's a kind of a risk in between, perhaps, and this risk has to do with massive imbalance of power. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's kind of already exists. You know, we already have mm-hmm. nuclear countries and non-nuclear mm-hmm. countries, mm-hmm. and you know, fortunately, nuclear powers don't just go and invade everywhere. You know, like they do have sovereign states that are weaker and can, in theory, be taken over, but they don't. So in a similar way, you know, maybe this is what would happen. There's also a kind of a risk of like AI just making, increasing inequality by making some people who have access to AI much more prosperous, much more, you know. So it's really a question about distribution of the benefits of the of AI. And making it available as a technology to everyone, you know, just like we've done with the internet, like we've done with vaccinations, we've done with all kinds of technologies that we've invented.
Mm-hmm. I was actually just thinking about what you mentioned right now. I think it is it is really like the question of who's benefiting in the end, and how are we able to distribute the benefits across countries, across economic classes, across, I think it is even like a difference, for example, just like on average spoken about like how are women benefiting, or are they even more marginalized right now, yeah. seeing that like IT is mostly like still referred to like men know better how to deal with these kind of things and how to use it for themselves. So I think there is still like a lot of potential, but there's also like a lot of challenges to like it. I think that what may be like shifted in the last couple of months even is that there is a huge awareness suddenly from like within the society that we need to start a conversation about mm-hmm. this. I guess most probably for you as a scientist working on these topics for many years, it is different, but I guess that like in the public discourse, it is also like observable that probably not enough yet, but still yeah. like the conversation started. But I think it is really a question on how to avoid the power imbalance or like the
I think that's a very important question and challenge. I mean, in some ways there are, I mean, things can go in either direction, you know, like I mean, just think of the internet, right? Like the internet could have been, I mean, it started as a military project. It could have stayed there, right? But it was instead, it was shared, it was open, it became like an open protocol, everybody could participate. And now we live in a world where the internet is transforming, you know, many parts of the third world by enabling new kinds of, you know, commerce and applications and kind of independence. I think the same with AI. It can go one way or another. It can be like, you know, the most powerful countries with the biggest computers can have enormous power because they're much more optimized, you know, their economy is optimized and their armies are optimized and so on. Or it could become, you know, a tool in the hands of everyone. And I think, yeah, there's massive development in open source models, or at least open weights models. So models that can, you know, you can download on your own machine and run it. And they are quite powerful, you know, even, and you can even run them on like consumer devices, and they're pretty good. They're not going to be the most powerful, but, you know, but I think it seems that things are at least so far moving in the direction of like more openness. And I think this is in large part thanks to the computer science culture of sharing. And, you know, it's really the culture rewards openness in many ways. And people have been leaving companies that don't have sufficiently open kind of practices. So I think in that sense, you know, I'm optimistic, but, you know, it's by no means guaranteed. And this will hopefully, you know, reduce this kind of digital divide, you know, which, you know, does exist in other areas, but I think is shrinking. And hopefully there will not be an AI digital divide.
Thank you. My last question, at least for today, is about a beautiful, but at the same time kind of sad example you said when you developed, I think, in 2017, deep empathy, like a model to kind of increase empathy. Can you talk a little bit and explain how it works?
Yeah, so this this was kind of a combination. It was an artistic, technical, and humanitarian kind of project. So at the time, we collaborated with UNICEF, and we for a campaign to fundraise for children, and specifically focusing on Syria. So the idea was to use these at the time emerging algorithms for style transfer. So this idea, you may remember, like there were these algorithms that will, you'll upload your photo and then it will make you look like a Van Gogh painting or a Monet or something like that. And you could use the same technology to transform Berlin, for example, into Aleppo. So in a sense, you use the destruction, you know, you have a photo of destruction of a city like Aleppo or Homs, and then you transform New York and Berlin to look destroyed as if it was destroyed by the Syrian civil war. And the idea is to, this would hopefully lead to people to empathize with the plight of the victims of war and people who have been displaced and so on. So I think, yeah, AI in some ways can help us, you know, usher a lot of destructions, but also can help us increase empathy and see the world from the perspective of others, or imagine ourselves in the shoes of others. At least I hope this is the case if we build it right. So,
did you get any results if it worked, if it really increased empathy?
Yeah, we found, I mean, we did some scientific, unfortunately, we didn't have a chance to publish this work. We found that it does work. But interestingly, we compared it. We were interested in whether it works better than just showing you a photo of Aleppo and having your imagination work. And, you know, bad news for the science, for the scientific paper, but maybe good news for humanity, that it doesn't always do better than the imagination. So imagination is quite powerful, you know, human imagination. And I think, you know, maybe sometimes imagination goes further than what the machines can show us. And I think maybe that's a good sign that machines still have a limitation, you know, like they still, our minds are still able to create worlds and create empathy that surpasses what machines can offer.
I feel that this was a very powerful last comment, actually.
Definitely.
We thank you so much for this wonderful conversation. I hope
thank
the
you.
Conversation continues with you also, like within society, between societies.
And machines.
Let's be inclusive. Yeah. Thank you so much
thank
for having
so
me.
Much.
Thank you.